No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony, along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, soon to be the smartest woman in America. Our show hopes to start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype your questions into BBSRADIO and the number 1. So here we are. Maria, we're back together. It's been a while.
You know what? When I looked at my watch last Sunday in the midst of classes, I thought it's a sure good thing that I didn't think I could slip out, because on Sunday, our professor was talking about storytelling and the arc, and you know how you get people here and then you drop them down here and then up and then down. And there was 6 different methodologies that he shared with different very persuasive people who are famous for this. And then he said, and now you have your assignment, and it has to be 3 to 5 minutes, and tell us a story. So we had to go and, you know, prepare, and then we had to couple up and run it past each other, and then we had to present not only to the cohort but to our faculty and to other staff that showed up. So it was this big frickin' deal. So I'm really glad. And he called on me first. I did it in 4 minutes, and he was effusive with his compliments, because I write it down, I follow the directions, I bring my life, you know, to the plateau or tableau, I should say, and did it. And these poor other students, who are adults, by the way, they have adult children too, some of them, they had put it into their laptop and were flipping through the PowerPoint of their life and looking at it and then looking up at us. And I was like, didn't you live this?
Well, so, you know what? I've got to tell you, when I was in college, not so much in graduate school, but when I was an undergraduate, it seemed to me to be the beginning of this revolution where women were coming back into the classroom after having raised children. You know, women that gave up going to college, and then they would raise a couple of kids or half raise the kids and then come back. And we always hated that because they were such good students.
Yep.
You know, we were out partying and, you know, wait until the end of the semester to get the textbook. And they had already had the recommended reading done by the second week. So they made it hard on us. But it was a little different in graduate school. Once we got to graduate school, then, you know, they brought a wealth of experience that I think we all benefited from. And I'm sure you bring a wealth of experience to the students in your program. And,
well,
you know,
interestingly enough, though, our cohort, there's only 9 of us, and they come from throughout the United States. And there were 2 trans, 3 African-American women, 1 Caucasian man, and 3 Caucasian women, if that math works out. So, and a lesbian. So in terms of diversity, you want to talk about a microcosm of all walks of life. That was fascinating.
Well, and you know what? I had a professor that used to say, if those of us who attempt to teach or who are bold enough to try and teach must never cease to learn. And, you know, so let me just say how proud everybody at Shadow Politics is of you for continuing on that journey, because it really, really shows just a remarkable sense of wanting to contribute. And that's really what this show is supposed to be about. And that's what we're you know, what we should all be about.
You know what? That's a really good point, Michael, because the degree is in media psychology. So basically it is people and their use of technology and the why. So why does someone use Twitter over Instagram over other formats? And then there's augmented reality, virtual reality, and then, as I mentioned prior, artificial intelligence. And it's scary, the artificial intelligence part that I learned, because, yeah, of course, it's here, right? You have Alexa and you have Siri and you have driverless cars, for an example. And there, what is most troublesome to me, and it's probably going to be something that I'm going to undertake personally, is there are no ethical guidelines at the present moment about what people can do and program into the technology.
Yeah, that is very scary.
None.
But, you know, I've got to tell you, I already see your doctoral dissertation out there, Donald Trump and Twitter. If you could explain his use of Twitter, I think you would be an instant success. And you'd be the new pop psychologist out there in the media.
How does that differ, though, from presidents using the fireside chat? Granted, it was limited.
It doesn't I don't think it does in terms of their motivation. You know, I think that politicians have always been motivated to try to find different ways to reach people and to reach the most people they can at any one given time, you know. It so I don't think the mindset of why you do it has changed so much as your ability to now instantly reach millions of people. I mean, it's just amazing. We thought, and you know, in politics, just to take politics for example, we've seen every new technology instantly brought into politics. The fireside chat you mentioned from the radio. But as soon as TV started, right, that became the big thing. You know, one of the classic stories in American politics is that the Nixon-Kennedy debates. People that heard it on the radio said that Nixon won. Mm-hmm. People that saw it on TV overwhelmingly chose Kennedy. You know, so, and that set in motion a whole new industry in politics on how to produce and put people in front of a camera to make them more appealing.
Well, and let's get into that with one side caveat, that President Obama, in especially his first election, was unprecedented in using technology for donations.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, that's another thing, because that's what I did as a political consultant, was I did direct mail, and we did all sorts of donations, kind of, you know, all sorts of things to get money into political campaigns. And yeah, we were always using new technology. And we even, I think one of the more creative things that we ever did was that when I worked for Jesse Jackson, I did work for Jesse Jackson when he first ran for president. And they did collections in black churches.
Oh, wow.
On Sunday, a special collection for him. I know that being raised as a Catholic, you know, special collections, right? They have special collections in churches from time to time.
Every week.
Yeah. Well, they did this for Jackson, and he made a fortune. First of all, you could collect up to a certain amount of cash without getting all the required information that's required of political contributions. And I can't remember what it's a pretty low threshold, but I think you could take $20 in cash and just call it anonymous. So they could do that with you know, passing around a collection plate. Number two, he was the first credible black candidate that ran for president, really. I mean, Shirley Chisholm ran earlier than he did, but he was the first one that anybody thought might even have a ghost of a chance. And so people were pretty generous. And they raised, on one Sunday, he raised, I can't remember how much, but it was well over $1 million. So, yeah, we're all.
Is there a church and state dilemma there or no? Because it's voluntary.
Well, yes. I don't think that the church could endorse his candidacy, and certainly there were churches that opted out on the basis of what you just said. There were churches that felt that, yes, it was a conflict of church and state, and they were afraid of losing their nonprofit status.
Right.
From, I can't remember how the legal part of it worked out, but they were able to work it out somehow so that it wasn't a conflict. But yes, that was a concern.
I would think so. I mean, yeah. I know the Catholic Church has always been an advocate for a lot of causes, and right. I often wonder about that too, because I, back in the day, at, you know, Cesar Chavez and organizing and unionizing the farm workers, I was little and in mass, and the priest started talking about boycotting grapes,
yeah.
And people were standing up and shouting and left the church in anger. And I didn't know anything about politics and unions. I, you know, I was too little, but the fact that it was creating that kind of uncomfortable public anger has stuck with me to this day.
Well, and you know, certainly the classic example is the guy that had the Crystal Cathedral.
What, yes.
I can't remember, was it Schuller? Was that his name, Urban Schuller?
That was one of them.
But yeah, he had the Crystal Cathedral in Los Angeles, and he lost his nonprofit status because he had a Ticketron outlet in it, among other things. So, you know, that was, he was making money. But, you know, and there's always been that problem with evangelism, right? We had
right.
Jim and Pammy Baker, and
exactly.
they
That's
created an amusement park, and you know, I mean, it's just amazing. But yeah, we're always looking. And, you know, I mean, I hate to date myself so much, but I was the director of direct mail services for in-house direct mail services for the Democratic Party, because that was the new technology, believe it or not, when I was coming up. We realized that the Republicans raise a ton more money than we did at the national level. But then what really got to us was they had a lower average contribution, and it made people sit up and take note that they were raising the money through direct mail. So they were raising more money, but the average contributor was given less to the Republicans than he gave to the Democrats. So the Democrats pumped millions of dollars into direct mail. And I was lucky enough to have come along at that point and started working for them. And that's where I ended up. And I learned a lot. But that
so, Michael,
was short-lived
share
technology.
With our younger listeners who don't aren't patrons of USPS what that means. Direct mail.
Well, you know, it's what I think is commonly referred to these days as snail mail.
Right.
You know, you actually go out and mail something, letters to people. So we would write fundraising letters, and we would try to use all sorts of technology to try to find people that we thought would be
potential donors,
right. And so we used – one of my favorite was we used a thing called Claritas. And there was a guy that from California who came up with this system where he took the entire United States and divided it into 40 neighborhoods. And he determined that the way you thought politically had more to do with where you lived than any other factor, than any other single factor they could come up with. So they had all these neighborhoods. And they had every part of the United States divided into one of 40 neighborhoods. And the one that I remember that sticks in my mind is there was a neighborhood called Furs and Station Wagons. and so what we would do is we would take a neighborhood like Furs and Station Wagons, and we would test them. And then if they responded positively, then we knew that all the other Furs and Station Wagon neighborhoods throughout the United States would respond.
In kind,
yes.
Proportionately so?
Yes.
Wow. So it's really a science that you developed.
Yes. And you know, you'd start out by going into one some of these neighborhoods, and you'd mail 5,000 pieces. But then if it worked, you could mail a million pieces and have it work. And you know, but of course, fundraising through the mail system was put out of business basically by the internet. Right. Because it's, you can send out a million emails for nothing, barely, and a million letters will cost you $500,000. Right. So, yeah. And, you know, the worst, it was fraught with peril, though, because I can tell you, we fought with the chairman of the Democratic Committee to send out a letter which was basically Ronald Reagan is not doing a good job and we don't like him as Democrats. And we sent that out, and the day we sent a million of them out, he was shot. He ran to the post office and begged them to give us the mail back. We were going to eat it, all the costs and everything, but they didn't. So it arrived in your home a week after he had been shot. Oh. And we got, I can't tell you, we got thousands of letters from Democrats saying, how dare you, you know, kick the president of the United States while he was down. We had to send out a telegram explaining that
a
we had
telegram.
Yes, which cost a fortune. It wasn't actually a telegram, it was a mailgram, but it was faster, you know. And we had to send out lots of them to people saying, look, of course we wouldn't say bad things about the president while he's laying in the hospital trying to recuperate. But yeah, that was one of the more traumatic moments that I had at the Democratic Committee when we were doing direct mail. But that's basically been replaced now with the internet. And the guy that did that was Howard Dean. He was the first one to get lots, at least on the Democratic side, to get lots and lots of donors through the internet. And that made that technology the new technology. And you know what? There'll be a new technology, another new technology.
Exactly. It'll probably be involved in cryptocurrency.
Probably involved in cryptocurrency. And you know what they say, that military secrets are the most fleeting, you know, military technology is the most obsolete because it's always being replaced. And the same thing can be said about politics. In politics, you know, everybody wants a new technology, and that leads to the perfect segue to tell you what I did today.
Yes, nicely done.
I have tormented over whether to run for re-election. I have to decide by next Friday whether to run for re-election.
What's the dilemma? Why?
The dilemma for me is that I get very little support from the district government, for example. We have anemic funding. I hardly have enough money to pay the people that work for me. I have a full-time person and a part-time person, and we have to scrape by on every, in every instance. I've paid more than $50,000 out of my own pocket to pick up my own expenses for this job. In addition to that, you know, I haven't been paid a dime in 6 years, and I have a wife that works two jobs so that I can do this. So it came to me that I had to make this decision. So what I've decided to do is, this office that I hold was created by the people of the District of Columbia. It was not created by the government. Every other office in the District of Columbia was created by the government, the council, the mayor. These were acts that were initiated by Congress through home rule, and these offices were created. But they had a constitutional convention that created my office. Of course, there are two senators, my office, Senator Strauss's office, and Representative Garcia's office. So I've decided to let the people decide whether I should continue or not.
And what does that look like?
Well, I'll tell you in a second. Let me just tell you, to illustrate what I'm up against, the D.C. government has just passed on the first reading a law which we're trying to get amended already, because it gives matching funds to people who run for public office, but they've exempted my office. My office would get no matching funds. So, and you know what? It doesn't even affect me, because it wouldn't take effect till 2020, and I get a 6-year term if I get elected. And I will be almost 72 years old by the time that term is up. So by that time, I'm hoping to be chasing a few grandchildren around. But the idea that they would leave us out degrades my office. So I'm fighting to have us. Yes. So I'm fighting to have us put back in. I need to collect. If you want to be on the city council and make $130,000 a year and get $1 million budget for your office, you need to get 250 people to nominate you. I need to get 8 times that many people to nominate me. You have to be more qualified for my office than any office in the district. You have to qualify under the Constitution, be 30 years old, be a citizen for 9 years, do all sorts of other things. So what I've decided is, by the way, you get nominated by getting petitions signed. So I have to get about 3,500 signatures in February and January, February, and the beginning of March by standing out at metro stops in the coldest weather. And I can't afford to get people to help me do this because I don't have any more money to put into this. So we're starting a GoFundMe campaign.
Oh.
And today I spent a day filming a commercial. I've gotten somebody who's been kind enough to reach out to me and help me do this. And we're going to put together a GoFundMe campaign. And you know what? If I can raise enough money to run, and it's not going to take a lot of money, maybe $10,000 or $15,000. If I can raise that much through small contributions so that I can pay people to get me signatures and do some of the other work that I need done, I'm gonna run. And if not, I'm not. I'm just going to fill out the next year of my term and do whatever I can to help move the ball forward and then move on and find something else to do. If the people of the District of Columbia and the people that has created and supported the office don't want it or don't want me in it, then I'm fine with that. So that's what I did today. I did like, and you'll appreciate this because you've got experience at this sort of thing, which I really don't, but I did like 20 takes. I couldn't believe how hard it was.
Yeah,
I thought,
it's tedious.
I'm going to stand in front of a camera and I'm going to go, "Hi, my name is Michael Brown and I'm running for," and everything happened from being outside and having the sun in the wrong place and having to reset up the whole thing to having skateboarders come by to having the tripod fall down on one leg in the middle of a sentence to having the teleprompter freeze or going too fast. So I'm really reading like this or going too slow. So I have to stop and pause. It was just, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I don't know how people do this.
Yeah.
You know, when we had all these grandiose plans about going in front of the Capitol and, which is, you can imagine, is a hassle today because of all that's going on Capitol Hill. Security is very tight and, you have to be very careful about how you do it. But we never even got around to that because it took so long. It took like 5 hours to do the 5 minutes that we filmed.
And that's another one of the reasons that I have never been attracted to that part of the profession of being in front of the camera is the minutia, because the adage is hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
And it's so true. I have a friend who just shot an episode of something on the Hulu network or something. Mm-hmm. And he had a 1 day scene and it went from 7:30 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And I was like, why? That sounds like just a waste of time. I know you're acting and you're in front of the camera and helps make people famous and stuff, but I would think that you've got better things to do.
Right. Well, right.
And as you just so said, the lighting and the sound and all that technical stuff that you don't have any control over. Fortunately, someone does, but that's what you're waiting around for.
But I'll tell you something. If you want to meet people, stand in front of a camera with a suit and tie, but like a real camera. We had lights and a teleprompter, and more people came by to see what was up. I was just amazed by it. Literally hundreds of people stopping to see, like, who is this guy?
What you should have had doing? Petitions there.
Well, that's right. Well, they're not released until Friday.
Oh, I see.
Or I would have, And it's funny you know, that all these people were just so attracted to that, to the camera. There's just something about it. But yeah, it's not easy. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. And, you know, maybe I won't raise any money. I don't know. But
what usually in traditional GoFundMe campaigns, somebody at a certain level of giving gets something out of it.
Yeah, I don't know what we do. I don't think we're not allowed to do that other than to promise you good government to say. And that's basically what I said. I said, look, I don't do this for the money. I certainly don't do it for the power. I do it because I'm trying to right an injustice. And if you care about that and can afford to kick in a couple of bucks, that would be great. I'm not asking anybody to, you know, to dip into their savings or to send me $1,000 or anything like that. I'm just saying, you know, can you consider funding a guy that needs to be funded to continue work that's really important work, in my opinion. And I will also reach out to volunteers this week to get volunteers to help me get signatures and stuff like that and to work on the campaign. And if we can get enough of them to do that, that would be great. You know,
so the other thing too is that if you don't reach your goal, are you going to refund the donations?
If I don't get enough money to make a usable contribution to my campaign, yes, I will absolutely do that.
Because I've heard that if you set a limit and you don't get there, then you don't get the money. It's like held in escrow or something.
Yeah.
And we have a caller on line two. Welcome to the program, David.
Yeah, hi. This is David Schwartzman.
Hey, David, how are you? Michael,
and I think I've been on the show once before. Of course, I think you know I'm with the D.C. State Green Party. And I actually ran against Michael for the Shadow Senate position. But I hope you, of course, he prevailed. But I hope, Michael, you do run, because I think you've done a very good job. And of all of our statehood delegation, you were the only one to really stand up and support the demand for a real constitutional convention. Although, and the council on October 18th of 2016 did approve a constitution which required an elected, delegated constitutional convention no more than 2 years after we achieved statehood. So I wanted to compliment you for that. But I did call in mainly to talk a little bit about what Ed Lazier said a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. Go ahead. But first, let me just say.
I thought that was a very good program. But you want to. Should I stop now and you want to respond to what I just said or what?
I just want to say that the reason I stood up for a constitutional convention and for real input from the citizens is that I think if you want democracy, you have to first practice it. And it didn't look like we weren't practicing democracy with what we did there. But in the end, we did get some of what we wanted, and that was good. So now go tell us what you have to say about our good friend Ed Lazier and what he had to say.
Yeah, well, I think, I think he explained things very well. But here is the question that you asked. So what should the council do, and what's fiscal policy's position regarding the federal tax legislation's impact on D.C.? He really haven't decided finally what to do about it, but we do oppose any tax cut in our local taxes, particularly a D.C. income tax. Right. And I think that was a good response, but I would go further. And this is actually connected to the stated issue because of who is underfunded by our budget. we're residents, what issues are underfunded? And as you put it very well, we are a tale of two cities. By the way, in 2014, I dressed up like Charles Dickens in a Fair Budget Coalition lobby at the council. And at the end, I got up on a podium and I said, you know, I really am a multimillionaire now because I got a lot of royalties since the 19th century. But I want to pay higher taxes. Tax me, raise my taxes. And I think that's the medicine we need. And what we have now is a tremendous opportunity, actually, to equal the tax cut that the very wealthy are getting from this federal legislation. And I can give you a few figures on this. This is actually a study that was recently done by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And they found that 78% of the total tax cut from the federal income tax, the new legislation in 2019, would be going to people making over $135,000 a year. 61% would actually go for people making over $350,000 a year. And it's possible to calculate how much this amounts to because we have figures from 2015, actually, and it's probably higher now, what the taxable income is of D.C. taxpayers according to their income. So the top, it turns out the top 1% from this federal tax legislation will get an average tax cut of $81,000. The poorest 20%, which average about less than $14,000 a year, will get a $120 tax cut. Okay?
Wow.
Now,
yep.
So how much money would actually be possible to generate to equalize this tax cut? And we can estimate it's at least $250 million a year. At least $250 million a year for the, which equals the total tax cut of very wealthy people. I mean, earning above about $200,000 a year. And so I think we should demand the following of the council, that they pass the appropriate legislation and, if necessary, adjust, and it looks like they're going to have to hike the top bracket, the top tax rate, modestly by a few percent, and then generate this a very important new source of revenue.
Well, you know what?
Go to affordable housing and so forth. And let me make just one final point. I'll be quiet.
Yeah.
This, if we urge this approach, these wealthy taxpayers would be paying the same overall taxes, that is D.C. income tax plus federal income tax, that they would be paid before. So they pay less to the federal and more to us. And it's a win-win situation. They would be even in their total tax liability.
Well, thanks for that, David. Thanks for that information. And
that sounds
positive. Yeah, it sounds like that may be a future show for us.
Uh-huh.
Because we can't really cover that.
But
thanks.
Come on.
Well, thanks for calling in, and we appreciate that, and we'll talk to you. Yes, off the air, maybe we can set up a show just to talk about that. But thanks so much for calling.
Matter of fact, I did send you and Karen an email outlining this. So look at your email.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you, Dr. Schwartzman. Just so you know, people out there, Dr. Schwartzman is a retired chemistry professor from Howard University, a brilliant man, and he does actually bear a striking resemblance to Charles Dickens. So there we go.
I didn't know what Charles Dickens looked like.
He looks like David Schwartzman. I'll send you a picture. Let's move on to what we plan to talk about.
Yes, but wait a second. One last, let's tie it back in. How can folks find your GoFundMe page?
We'll let you know in a few weeks. We haven't set it up yet.
Oh, I see.
We're just, we're in the process of, So we'll let you know. But let's talk about statehood. Okay. California wants to be the 51st state.
Yeah. Let's up now, what does that do to your... Well, you know, every story says it's a long shot, and I'm curious, just if folks don't know, they announced last Monday establishing a state known as New California, and it excludes the coastal areas from basically the San Francisco Bay Area down through Los Angeles. So I would be in that geographic exclusion, which would be considered California.
Old California.
New California would be the 51st state.
Yes, and you know what? Just so people know, this is not really this. What they announced on Monday is a new idea, but there's been talk of this since I was shocked to find out 1850. California became a state in 1850, but there was a group of people in Modoc and Siskiyou counties. I don't even know how to pronounce the last one. Must be an Indian name. Siskiyou counties in Northern California and Oregon that go back to the 1850s in wanting to create their own state out of California.
Well, usually what we've heard in common day is that Northern California would like to secede from Southern California because we do down here take a lot of natural resources from Northern California, most specifically water. And because they don't have any problem in general with their rain supply and their snowpack and snow melt and all of that sort of thing. So that's been the issue that is more modern day. But for whatever, you know, because keep in mind, too, Northern California has Silicon Valley, and imagine what that tech space is like for real estate, because the prices were already unaffordable before the dot-com hit. And now I think I told you my nephew, who graduated from Berkeley last year with a degree in physics, got a job with a dot-com, and he's renting a couch for $1,500 a month.
Unbelievable. We hear these stories about North Dakota, too, where they had the shale oil boom.
The fracking.
You know, the fracking, yes. So, you know, it's an interesting idea. But, you know, what would this lead to? Would this lead to gerrymandering in all sorts of, you know, how do we decide who goes into New California and Old California? Would they be drawing lines based on the fact that, you know, you've mentioned water, but there must be other issues. One issue that I've certainly heard is that some Republicans feel that they really don't have much of a say in California so liberally democratic.
I see it red versus blue within the state, and the blue is those affluent coastal areas. You know, Mendocino, where the mudslides were. I couldn't, by the way, get to school last week because of the road closures. And fortunately, Amtrak was able to open up the train track, because Santa Barbara takes about 55 minutes for me to drive to. And the rerouting was going to be a 5-hour drive, because it was going to be far east, far north, and then drop down south to get to Santa Barbara. So Amtrak opened up, and we got to pass right through Montecito and see the damage firsthand.
Wow.
It was terrible. And
just what was on TV was just horrible.
Single-family dwellings that are unremarkable are like $2 million in Mendocino. Right. I mean, you know, Oprah had the single largest real estate transaction when she bought her enclave, I think, for $65 million.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing it. It's Montecito. Mendocino is in Northern California.
Right.
Montecito. Yeah. So it's But so the areas they've carved out are very liberal and very wealthy in general, because it's the Pacific coast, right? So there's only so much ocean available and ocean front, et cetera. And I think that's really probably the motive behind this, is to get a California that actually could have some Republican traction.
Well, and you know, it's not something that hasn't been mentioned in the case of D.C. too. You know, there are people, one of the ways that D.C. could become a state actually is through a thing called retrocession, going and connecting with another state, retroceding back to the people that gave the land to the District of Columbia. That was Maryland and Virginia. And actually there's a precedent for this, because we gave back the Virginia portion of DC. DC used to be a perfect square, and now it looks more like kind of a strange triangle, because we gave all the land that was given to us from Virginia back to Virginia back in the 1800s, when there were wealthy people in Virginia that felt that D.C. was going to abolish slavery, and they didn't want to be any, they didn't want to have any part of that. And we were the first place to abolish slavery in the United States. So there's even a precedent for it. And people generally talk about going back to Maryland, but there have been some people that suggested that we should go, we should make a new state that incorporates Northern Virginia. Because Northern Virginia around D.C. is very liberal. The rest of Virginia is pretty conservative and mostly Republican. But, of course, Northern Virginia is also a heavily populated area. So there are people that that have said, you know, if – because part of our problem is that this is a partisan problem. This is the biggest part of our problem. And right. we're all Democrats here in D.C. But they say, this way you can give something to the Republicans. You can say, look, we'll take your Democrats and include them with our Democrats in a new state, and then you'll have a solidly Republican state again. And that may be, you know, something that they would be interested in.
Michael, we've never discussed this before, but whether or not that happens, or you do get statehood for D.C., what happens to the land that the White House is on? And that
well, that's why we want statehood, because it's the easiest way for us to deal with the situation we find ourselves in, which is unique, different than California, different than Puerto Rico. And that is, the Constitution says in Article 1, Section 8, that the Congress should have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over a district not to exceed 10 miles square. But it doesn't say how small that district can be. So what we would do is we would carve out a thing called the National Capital Service Area, and that would be the White House, the Mall area, Congress, all
the
buildings on the Mall, yes. And those federal buildings would remain the federal national capital, and the surrounding area where we all live, Adams Morgan, Georgetown, AU Park, all the neighborhoods would become the state of New Columbia. So there's no need to change the Constitution. The seat of government would still be all that area, but the only residents in that area would be the president and his family. The only people that actually live there would live in the White House, and of course they're represented outside of Washington, D.C. anyway.
Right, where they're registered to vote, right?
Basically. Right. So Obama still voted in Illinois.
Right. Yeah. Now, right. Would it be akin, and could it be possible to do something as the Vatican does in Italy?
Yes.
And that it's sovereign?
That's another thing that gets tossed around from time to time. Yes. And it could be. But the thing about statehood for the district, for example, and this would be would also apply to Puerto Rico and California, is that the Constitution under Article 4, which sets up the states, says in Section 2 the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the several states. So that's why statehood resolves all our problems. We don't have control over our budget. We don't control our legal system. We don't have any representation in either House of Congress. And all this goes away because under Article 4, all states are absolutely equal. And so that – so if you do, for example, what you say with the Vatican and sovereignty, it still causes some problems for us in getting back our budget and getting control of some other things, you know. Statehood resolves it all for us. So we see it as the easiest, most direct, and most encompassing, you know, all-encompassing solution to our problems. And, you know, and that's one thing that's interesting about the problem in, you know, the way it's outlined in New California. There's a different motivation for wanting to do this than we have. And Puerto Rico is the same. They have a different motivation, and their motivation, they've been citizens of the United States for over 100 years, but their motivation is that you know, they would get representation. They can't even vote for president. So they would get representation, and given what's happened lately, how devastated they've been down there, they would have access to a lot more federal funding.
So that, and how is that going with the coalition that they appointed, which, so I recall, well, was five prestigious folks?
Yes, seven actually, and we five representatives and two senators, and we met with them just last week, and actually tried to get one of them to come on the show this week, and probably will be successful in the next few weeks of getting him to come on. Unfortunately, he was on his way back to Puerto Rico, so he couldn't do it. He got caught in the middle of travel and other stuff. But, yes, they're very serious about it, but they really don't have a lot of money to put into it. And they get, you know, their circumstance is a little different. If D.C. becomes a state, they get two senators and a representative. If Puerto Rico becomes a state, they get between five and six representatives and two senators.
Because so it's of a much, their population.
Yeah, because of their population. Because, of course, the House is based on population. And so it's a little different. They would also come in as the poorest state in the United States. The per capita income in Puerto Rico is approximately half of what it is in Mississippi. Wow. So, yeah. Ow. So, but
it's such a beautiful enclave and tourism and yeah. All, but I guess that's only the tip of the iceberg, huh?
Well, that's the downside. The upside for them, for example, is that the Republicans like it more than they like D.C. because they don't pay federal income taxes on any income that's earned in Puerto Rico. So Republicans in Congress see a lot of money, the tourist money and stuff. That's
and not, the pharmaceuticals.
Right. That's not taxable. And two, they tend to be more Republican than the district, which is solidly Democratic, you know, and they've been very sensitive to that. Their delegation is actually made up of three Republicans, three Democrats, and one independent. And, you know,
interesting.
Yeah, because they were appointed. And as you probably know, until the Constitution was amended, senators were appointed by the governor of each state. So they've gone back to that old system of appointing their representatives, which is certainly acceptable given that these representatives aren't the same as other representatives. So,
Michael, yeah. In your discussion about the District of Columbia, why do you not talk about West Virginia?
I don't follow. Why West Virginia?
Well, it has proximity too.
Yeah, it does have proximity. I think that the feeling is that the West Virginians which actually West Virginia is a good example because they were part of Virginia at one time. Right. They're an example for California because they did exactly what California is talking about doing. But they don't see the benefit. When they talk about Virginia, they really talk about us sucking all the liberals out of Virginia because they really – the vast majority of them are in the Washington metropolitan area. And that's not true in West Virginia. Also, retrocession is more often talked about with Maryland because all the land, which is now the District of Columbia, is originally from Maryland. You know, I think if we're going to retrocede, we should retrocede to Alaska because they get that nice – payment from the oil companies, you know? And that would be nice. And think of how nice it would be for them to get out of there in the winter time.
Like your winters are any better?
No, they're really not. And yeah. Nobody, you know, a half an inch of snow, and I'm sure as a Southern Californian, you can relate to this. But an inch of snow in Washington paralyzes it. It's just amazing. It's like,
is that right?
It's like never seen this stuff before. Yeah.
And before we continue, what is your election cycle like if you choose to run for re-election? Is there a primary?
Yes. And that's really in the District of Columbia.
Okay. So we lost the senator, and hopefully we can get him back because I'm always impressed with the fount of information that he has. And he was just explaining with us of what the election cycle is like, and he did confirm that there is a primary, but I think he was going to say that there's not very many Republicans that run, and therefore he might be running unopposed. But I was going to suggest to him that what we have here in California is we've changed our primaries to as many people can run, and the two highest vote getters are the ones that get on the ballot in November. So what we saw last year was, because California is so blue, that the folks who were the two highest vote getters in most of the offices were Democrats. So as a registered Republican, I went to the polls and I had only Democrats as choices in front of me. And I was, it looks like I'm going to be able to visit the senator and the District of Columbia in April for school. And that's why I had suggested it to him that we do a campaign event and broadcast live from there, and folks can donate money to have access to the broadcast. And he said to me, won't you lose your credibility in the Republican Party by campaigning for a Democrat? And I was like, well, is there a Republican running in the District of Columbia? So we'll find all of that out if he chooses to run for re-election, which I sure hope he does. He's got the most amazing heart and incredible support from his wife and his family and obviously others in the community. And I would hate to see that passion not be a part of the statehood thing. But having come to the program not really knowing about the struggles of Washington, D.C. folks, what I keep saying is I don't get it. It is unfair. It is taxation without representation. And I don't care if that sounds un-Republican. It's just not right. And my local Congress member, I mentioned something to him about the program, and he was like, heck, our county has more people in it than the District of Columbia. Why don't you give us those representatives? And I was like, nah, that's not how it works. So I really hope that he does continue the pursuit on behalf of the citizens of District of Columbia.
Maria, they lost me.
Yes, I know. You were right in the middle of explaining about the primary.
Oh, well, the primary is a preferential primary. Democrats and Republicans, independents get to run in the general election but not in the primary. So that's what's up. And the primary in D.C. is everything. If you win the Democratic primary, you win. So really, what I have to do, that's why it wouldn't cost a lot of money for me to run, because I really only have to run a full-blown campaign from the end of January to the beginning of June.
Do you have challengers in the Democrat Party, and do you have challengers in that are Republicans?
Always have had, but don't
have any as of yet. We'll find out at the end of the week, because that's when the process really starts. By picking
Is that
up
called
petition.
Pulling papers?
Yeah, pulling papers.
Okay, so that's what we call it in California.
So, I have had Republican challengers. David Schwarzman, as you said, as you heard, was my Green Party challenger one time. I've had also Democratic challengers. In fact, the last time I ran for this office, I think I spent like $15,000 of my own money, pretty much, to run. And the guy that ran against me spent over $200,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And if that isn't a validation.
And I got 80% of the vote.
Wow.
He was not a nice man. He was also a Democrat, but he was not a nice man. He had gone to jail, and you know, he's a very wealthy guy, but you know, he had tax fraud charges and all sorts of things. So, but yeah, we'll see. But you know, I've done very well, Marie. I've run in several different elections. I ran in a citywide city council election where I beat both Washington Post candidates with no money, and I came in one spot behind the winner out of 15 candidates. So competition doesn't bother me, but standing out
well,
at metro
stations in February.
Well, I was
wondering, what about city
did.
Councilor or supervisor or other
yeah.
positions?
Well, you know what? This is a good thing, and I want to see it. I haven't ruled out running for something else, but and I haven't finally made up my mind, but certainly I'm happy to represent the people of District Columbia, and I think this is an important issue. And so, you know, it's an office worthy of certainly my effort. I'm just not sure why the city government doesn't support it better. But we'll see. I'm fighting
well, and
with
I was
everybody.
Sharing with our listeners that I will be out in April, and I'm hoping to have that be an opportunity for us to attend one of your fundraising events
yeah.
or your meet and greets
something.
Or whatever.
And certainly,
that would be nice.
We're already, you know, preparing to roll out the red carpet and, you know, make sure that your visit here in Washington is as wonderful as we can make it. Because we're,
thank you.
And we're so
I look forward
excited
to it. I haven't been there since 2009 or 10, so it's been too long.
It's changed a lot. I think you'll notice, right, as soon as you come in. But anyway, people, we're out of time.
Yes.
We're going to
So thank you for
tonight.
Sharing with us about what's going on. And
yes,
thank
you.
You're welcome, and I hope everyone has a fabulous week. And as always, we know there's lots of chatter out there, and we are very grateful that you've found us and chosen us and listen, because if it weren't for you, we wouldn't be here.
Exactly. So thank you, and we're going to leave you tonight with a classic from Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land. Thanks, people.
Give the people their right to vote.